Chapter 7. When he got home, there was not a soul in the house. For an instant, he was overcome by panic. No, he thought.
Margot!
He called. All the rooms were deserted. He wandered about, trying to keep control of himself. And then he noticed that the back door was open. Going out into the backyard, he looked around. Still no sign of them. Regal or Margot or Sammy. None of them. He walked down the path, past the clothesline, past the rose arbor, to Sammy's clubhouse built against the back fence. As soon as he rapped on the door, a peep slot slid open, and his son's eye appeared.
"Oh, hello, Dad,"
Sammy said. At once the door was unbolted and held open for him. Inside the clubhouse, Regal sat at the table, the earphones on his head. Margot sat beside him, at a great sheaf of paper. Both of them had been writing. Sheet after sheet was covered with rapid jottings.
"What's going on?" Vic said.
Margot said, "We are monitoring."
"So I see," he said. "But what are you bringing in?"
Regal, with the earphone still on his head, turned and with a gleam in his eye said,
"We're picking them up."
"Who?"
Vic said.
"Who's them?"
"Regal says it may take years to find out," Margot said, her face animated, her eyes bright. Sammy stood stock still, in a trance of ecstasy. The three of them were in a state he had never witnessed before. "But we have a way of overhearing them," she said. "And we've already started keeping notes. Look." She pushed the sheaf of paper at him. "Everything they say. We're writing it all down."
"Ham operators?" Vic said.
"That," Regal said. "And communication between ships and their field. Evidently, there's a field very close to here."
"Ships?" Vic echoed. "You mean ocean ships?"
Regal pointed up.
"Christ," Vic thought.
And he felt then the same tension and wildness, the frenzy.
"When they go over," Margot said, "they come in strong and clear for about a minute. Then they fade out. We can hear them talking, not just signals, but conversation. They kid a lot."
"Great kidders," Regal said. "Jokes all the time."
"Let me listen," Vic said.
When he had seated himself at the table, Regal passed the earphones to him and fitted them over his head.
"You want me to tune it?" Regal said. "I'll tune and you just listen. When a signal comes in good and clear, tell me. I'll leave the beat at that point."
A signal came in presently. Some man giving information about some industrial process. He listened, and then he said,
"Tell me what you've figured out."
He felt too impatient to listen. The voice droned on.
"What can you tell?"
"Nothing yet," Regal said with no loss of satisfaction. "But don't you see? We know they're there."
"We knew that already," Vic said. "Every time they flew over."
Both Regal and Margot, and Sammy too, seemed a little taken aback. After a pause, Margot glanced at her brother. Regal said,
"It's a hard concept to explain."
From outside the clubhouse, a voice called,
"Hey, fellas! Where are you?"
Margot raised her hand warningly. They listened. Someone, in their yard, was looking for them. Vic heard footsteps on the path. And then the voice again, this time closer.
"People?"
Softly, Margot said,
"It's Bill Black."
Sammy slid back a peep slot.
"Yeah,"
he whispered.
"It's Mr. Black."
Lifting his son aside, Vic got down and peeped through the peep slot. Bill Black stood in the center of the walk, obviously searching for them. On his face was an expression of aggravation and puzzlement. No doubt he had gone inside the house, finding it unlocked and nobody there.
"I wonder what he wants," Margot said. "Maybe if we keep quiet, he'll go away. Probably wants us all to have dinner with them or go out somewhere."
They waited. Bill Black strolled about aimlessly, kicking at the grass.
"Hey, fellas!"
he called.
"Where the heck are you?"
Silence.
"I'd sure feel silly if he caught us hiding in here," Margot said with a nervous laugh. "It's as if we were children or something. He certainly looks funny, craning his neck like that, trying trying to spot us, as if he thought we were hiding in the tall grass.
Mounted on the wall of the clubhouse was a toy gun that Vic had given his son one Christmas. It had fins and coils sticking up from it, and the box had described it as a robot rocket blaster from the 23rd century, capable of destroying mountains. Sammy had scampered about clicking it for a few weeks, and then the spring had broken and the gun had gone up on the wall, trophy-like, to scare by its presence alone. Vic lifted the gun down. He unlocked the clubhouse door, pushed it open, and stepped back. Standing with his back to him, Bill Black called,
"Hey, people! Where are you?"
Vic crouched down and held the gun up, pointed at Black.
"You're a dead man," he said.
Spinning to face him, Black saw the gun. He blanched and half-raised his arms. Then he noticed the clubhouse, Regal and Margot and Sammy peeping out, and the fins and coils and bright enamel of the gun. His hands dropped, and he said,
"Ha ha!
Ha ha!"
Vic said.
"What were you doing?"
Black said. From inside the Nielsen's house, Junie Black appeared. She descended the porch steps slowly to join her husband. Both she and Bill frowned and drew together. She put her arm around his waist. Black said nothing, then,
"Hi,"
Junie said. Margot stepped from the clubhouse.
"What were you doing?"
she asked Junie in a voice that any woman would shrink at.
"Just making yourself at home in our house?"
The Blacks gazed at them.
"Oh, come on,"
Margot said, standing with her arms folded.
"Just make yourself at home."
"Take it easy,"
Vic said. To him, his wife said,
"Yes, they just walked right in. Into every room, I imagine. How did you find it?"
she asked June.
"Beds made properly? Any dust on the curtains? Find anything you liked?"
Regal and Sammy came out of the clubhouse and joined Vic and his wife. The four of them faced Bill and Junie Black. At last, Black said,
"I apologize for trespassing on your property. We wondered if you'd like to go bowling with us tonight."
Beside her husband, Junie smiled idiotically. Vic felt a little sorry for her. She had clearly no idea that she would offend anyone. Probably she had not even been conscious of transgression. In her sweater and blue cotton trousers, her hair tied up with a ribbon, she looked very cute and childlike.
"I'm sorry," Margot said, "but you shouldn't barge into other people's houses. You know that, Junie."
Junie drew back, flinching and unhinged.
"I..."
she murmured.
"I said I apologize," Black said. "What do you want, for Christ's sake?"
He seemed equally perturbed. Vic put out his hand and they shook hands. All was over.
"You stay if you want," Vic said to Regal, indicating the clubhouse. "We'll go on inside and see about dinner." "And what do you have in there?"
Black said.
"I mean, if it's none of my business, tell me. But you're sure in a serious mood."
Sammy spoke up.
"You can't come in the clubhouse."
"Why not?"
Junie said.
"You're not members," Sammy said.
"Can we join?"
Junie said.
"No,"
Sammy said.
"Why not?"
"You just can't,"
Sammy said, glancing at his father.
"That's right," Vic said. "I'm sorry."
He and Margot and the Blacks walked up the steps, onto the back porch of the house.
"We haven't had dinner,"
Margot said, still tense with hostility.
"We didn't mean go bowling now,"
Junie protested.
"We just wanted to catch you before you made plans. Look, kids, if you haven't started dinner, why don't you come over and eat with us? We've got a leg of lamb, and there's plenty of frozen peas, and Bill picked up a quart of ice cream on the way home from work."
She appealed to Margot with tremulous urgency.
"What say?"
"Thanks," Margot said, "but maybe some other time."
Bill Black did not seem to have quite calmed down. He kept aloof from them, dignified and somewhat cool.
"You know you're always welcome in our house," he said.
He led his wife in the direction of the front door.
"If you feel like going bowling with us, drop over about 8. If not,"
he shrugged,
"well, no harm done."
"We'll see you,"
Junie called as Bill led her out of the house.
"I hope you come."
She smiled yearningly at them, and then the door shut after them.
"What a pill," Margot said.
Opening the hot water tap, she ran water into a kettle. Vic said, "A whole psychological technique could be erected on how people act when they're startled, before they have time to think." As she fixed dinner, Margot said, "Bill Black just seems rational. He put up his hands until he saw it was only a toy gun, and then he put them down again." Vic said, "What are the chances of his wandering over at that particular moment?"
"One of them is always over here. You know how they are."
"True," he said. In the locked clubhouse, Regal Gum sat with the earphones on, monitoring a strong signal and making occasional notes. Over the years, in his contest work, he had learned excellent systems of quick notation, all his own. As he listened, he not only made a permanent record of what he heard, but he also jotted down comments and the ideas and reactions of his own. His ballpoint pen, one that Bill Black had given him, flew. Watching him, Sammy said,
"You sure write fast, Uncle Regal. Can you read it when you get finished?"
"Yes," he said.
The signal, beyond a doubt, emanated from the nearby landing field. He had got so he recognized the voice of the operator. What he wanted to find out was the nature of the traffic coming into and leaving the field. Where did they go? They shot overhead at terrific speed. How fast? Why did nobody in town know about the flights? Was it a secret military installation? Some new experimental ships that the public was ignorant of? Reconnaissance missiles? Tracking devices? Sammy said,
"I'll bet you helped crack the Japanese code during World War II."
Hearing the boy say that, Regal once again had a sudden and complete sensation of futility. Shut up in a child's clubhouse, an earphone pressed to his head, listening for hours to a crystal set built by a grammar school child, listening to ham operators and traffic instructions like a school child himself. "I must be crazy," he said to himself. "I'm the man who's supposed to have fought in a war. I'm 46 years old, supposedly an adult." "Yes," he thought. "And I'm a man who lies around the house scrounging a living by filling out 'Where will the little green man be next?' puzzles in a newspaper contest, while other adults have jobs, wives, homes of their own. I'm a retarded psychotic. Hallucinations. Yes," he thought. "Insane, infantile, and lunatic. What am I doing sitting here? Daydreams, at best. Fantasies about rocket ships shooting by overhead. Armies and conspiracies. Paranoia. A paranoiac psychosis. Imagining that I'm the center of a vast effort by millions of men and women involving billions of dollars and infinite work. A universe revolving around me. Every molecule acting with me in mind. An outward radiation of importance. To the stars. Regal Gum, the object of the whole cosmic process, from the inception to final entropy. All matter and spirit, in order to wheel about me." Sammy said,
"Uncle Regal, do you think you can crack their code, like the Japanese code?"
Rousing himself, he said, "There's no code. They're just talking like anybody. It's some man sitting in a control tower watching military aircraft land." He turned toward the boy, who was watching him with fixed intensity. "Some fellow in his 30s who shoots pool once a week and enjoys TV, like we do."
"One of the enemy," Sammy said.
With anger, Regal said,
"Forget that kind of talk. Why do you say that? It's all in your mind."
"My fault," he realized. "I put it there." In his earphones, the voice said,
"All right, LF-3488, I have it down in corrected form. You can go ahead." "Yes, you should be practically overhead."
The clubhouse shook.
"There one goes," Sammy said excitedly.
The voice continued,
"Entirely clear. No, it's fine. You're passing over him now."
"Him," Regal thought.
"Down there," the voice said. "Yes, you're looking down at Regal Gum himself. Okay, we have you. Let go."
The vibrations subsided.
It's gone, Sammy said. Maybe it landed.
Setting down the earphones, Regal Gum got to his feet.
You listen for a while, he said.
Where are you going? Sammy asked.
For a walk, Regal said.
He unlocked the door of the clubhouse and stepped outside into the fresh, brisk evening air. The kitchen light of the house, his sister and brother-in-law in the kitchen, fixing dinner. I'm leaving, Regal said to himself. I'm getting out of here. I meant to before. Now I can't wait.
Walking carefully down the path around the side of the house, he reached the front porch. He entered the house and got into his room without either Vic or Margot hearing him. There, he gathered up all the money he could find in his assorted dresser drawers, clothes, unopened envelopes, change from a jar. Putting on a coat, he left the house by the front door and walked rapidly off down the sidewalk. A block or so away, a cab approached. He waved his arms and the cab stopped.
"Take me to the Greyhound bus station," he told the driver.
"Yes, Mr. Gum," the driver said.
"You recognize me?"
Here it was again, the projection of the paranoiac infantile personality, the infinite ego. Everyone aware of me, thinking about me.
"Sure," the driver said as he started up his cab. "You're that contest winner. I saw your picture in the paper and I remarked, 'Why, that guy lives right here in town. Maybe one day I'll pick him up in my cab.'"
So it was legitimate, Regal thought. The odd blurring of reality and his insanity. Genuine fame plus the fantasy fame. When cab drivers recognize me, he decided, it's probably not in my mind. But when the heavens open and God speaks to me by name, that's when the psychosis takes over. It would be hard to distinguish. The cab moved along the dark streets, past houses and stores. At last, in the downtown business section, it drew up before a 5-story building and stopped at the curb.
"Here you are, Mr. Gum,"
the driver said, starting to leap out to open the door. Reaching into his coat for his wallet, Regal stepped from the cab. He glanced up at the building as the driver reached for the bill. In the streetlight, the building was familiar. Even at night, he recognized it. It was the Gazette building. Getting back into the cab, he said,
"I want to go to the Greyhound bus station."
"What?"
the driver said, thunderstruck.
"Is that what you told me? I'll be darned. Of course it was."
He jumped back in and started up the engine.
"Sure, I remember. But we got to talking about that contest of yours, and I got to thinking about the newspaper."
As he drove, he swung his head around, grinning back at Regal.
"I've got you so tied in with the Gazette in my mind. What a sap I am."
"It's okay," Regal said.
They drove on and on. Eventually, he lost track of the streets. He had no idea where they were. The nocturnal shapes of closed-up factories lay off to the right, and what appeared to be railroad tracks. Several times, the cab bucked and floundered as it passed over tracks. He saw vacant lots, an industrial district with no lights showing. "I wonder," Regal thought, "what would the cab driver say if I asked him to drive me out of town?" Leaning forward, he tapped the driver on the shoulder.
"Hey," he said.
"Yes, Mr. Gum,"
the driver said.
"What about driving me out of town? Let's forget the bus."
"I'm sorry, sir," the driver said. "I can't get out on the road between towns. There's a rule against it. We're city carriers. We can't compete with the bus line. It's an ordinance."
"You ought to be able to make a few extra bucks on the side. 40-mile trip with your meter running? I'll bet you've done it, ordinance or no ordinance."
"No, I never done that," the driver said. "Some other drivers maybe, but not me. I don't want to lose my permit. If the highway patrol catches a city cab out on the highway, they haul it right down. And if it's got a fare in it, bam, there goes the driver's permit. A 50-buck permit. And his livelihood."
To himself, Regal thought, "Are they out to keep me from leaving the town? Is this a plot on their part?" My lunacy again, he thought. Or is it? How can I tell? What proof do I have? A blue neon glow hung in the center of a limitless flat field. The cab approached it and stopped at a curb.
"Here we are," the driver said. "This is the bus station."
Opening the door, Regal got out onto the sidewalk. The sign did not read Greyhound. It read, "Nonpareil Coach Lines."
"Hey," he said, jolted. "I said Greyhound."
"This is Greyhound," the driver said. "The same as. It's the bus line. There isn't any Greyhound here. The state only allows one bus line to be franchised for a town this size. Nonpareil got in here years ago, before Greyhound. Greyhound tried to buy them out, but they wouldn't sell. Then Greyhound tried..."
"Okay," Regal said.
He paid the fare, tipped the driver, and walked across the sidewalk to the square brick building, the only building for miles around. On each side of it, weeds grew. Weeds and broken bottles. Litter of paper. Deserted region, he thought. At the edge of town. Far off, he could see the sign of a gas station, and beyond that, streetlights. Nothing else. The night air made him shiver as he opened the wooden door and stepped into the waiting room. A great blast of rackety, distorted sound and tired blue air rolled out over him. The waiting room, packed with people, confronted him. The benches had already been taken over by sleeping sailors and despondent, exhausted-looking pregnant women, by old men in overcoats, salesmen with their sample cases, children dressed up and fretting and squirming. A long line stood between him and the ticket window. He could see, without going any farther, that the line was not moving. He closed the door after him and joined the line. Nobody paid any attention to him. "This is one time I wish my psychosis would come true," he thought to himself. "I'd like to have all this revolve around me, at least to the extent of making the ticket window available to me." How often, he wondered, does Nonpareil Lines run its buses? He lit a cigarette and tried to make himself comfortable. By leaning against the wall, he could take some weight off his legs, but it did not help much. "How long will I be tied up here?" he asked himself. A half hour later, he had moved forward only a few inches, and no one had left the window. Craning his neck, he tried to see the clerk behind the window. He could not. A wide, elderly woman in a black coat held the first place in line. Her back was to him, and he assumed that she was involved in buying her ticket. But she did not finish. The transaction did not end. Behind her, a thin, middle-aged man in a double-breasted suit gnawed on a toothpick and looked bored. After him, a young couple murmured together, intent on their own conversation. And after that, the line merged into itself, and he could make out nothing but the back of the man ahead of him. After 45 minutes, he still stood in the same spot. "Can a lunatic go out of his mind?" he wondered. "What does it take to get a ticket on the Nonpareil lines? Will I be here forever?" A growing fright began to settle over him. Maybe he would stand in this line until he died. Unchanging reality. The same man ahead of him, the same young soldier behind him, the same unhappy, empty-eyed woman seated on the bench across from him. Behind him, the young soldier stirred fitfully, bumped against him, and muttered, "Sorry, buddy." He grunted back. The soldier locked his hands together and cracked his knuckles. He licked his lips, and then he said to Regal, "Hey, buddy, can I ask you a favor? Will you hold my place in line?" Before Regal could answer, the soldier turned to the woman standing behind him. "Lady, I gotta make sure my buddy's okay. Can I get back in line here without losing my place?" The woman nodded. "Thanks," the soldier said, and pushed a passage through the people over to the corner of the waiting room. In the corner, another soldier sat with his legs apart, his face resting on his knee, his arms hanging down. His compatriot dropped down next to him, shook him, and began talking urgently to him. The bent-over soldier raised his head, and Regal saw the bleary eyes and twisted slack mouth of the drunk. "Poor guy," he thought to himself. "Out on a toot." During his own days in the service, he had several times wound up in a dismal bus station with a hangover, trying to get back to the base. The soldier sprinted back to his place in line. Agitated, he plucked at his lip, glanced up at Regal, and said,
"This here line, it isn't moving one bit. I think I must have been standing here since 5 this afternoon."
He had a smooth young face, tormented now by anxiety.
"I have to get back to my base," he said. "Phil and I have to be in by 8 o'clock or we're AWOL."
To Regal, he appeared to be 18 or 19. Blonde, somewhat thin. Clearly, he of the two of them did the problem-solving.
"Too bad," Regal said. "How far is your base?"
"It's the airfield up the highway," the soldier said. "The missile base, actually. Used to be an airfield."
Regal thought, "By God, where those things take off and land."
"You've been hitting the bars down here?"
he said in as conversational a voice as he could manage. The soldier said,
"Hell no, not in this jerkwater dump."
His disgust was enormous.
"No, we come all the way in from the coast. We had a week furlough. Driving."
"Driving," Regal repeated. "Well, why are you in here?"
The young soldier said,
"Phil's the driver. I can't drive. And he hasn't sobered up. It's just a crummy old jalopy. We dumped it. We can't wait around for him to sober up. Anyhow, it needs a new tire. It's back along the road with a flat. It's only worth about $50. It's a 36 Dodge.
"If you had somebody who could drive," Regal said, "would you go on by car?"
"I can drive," he was thinking. The soldier, staring at him, said,
"What about the tire?"
"I'll chip in on it," he said.
Taking hold of the soldier by the arm, he led him out of the line and across the waiting room to his hunched-over buddy.
"Maybe he better stay here until we get the car going," he said.
The soldier, Phil, didn't look as if he could walk very far or very well. He appeared to understand only vaguely where he was. To him, the soldier said,
"Hey, Phil, this guy's going to drive. Give me the keys."
"Is that you, Wade?"
Phil groaned from his coma. Wade crouched down and rooted in his buddy's pockets.
"Here,"
he said, finding the keys and handing them to Regal.
"Listen," he said to Phil, "you stay here. We're going to walk back to the car and get it running. We'll drive by and pick you up, okay? You got that?"
Phil nodded.
"Let's go,"
Wade said to Regal. As they pushed open the door and stepped out of the waiting room onto the dark, cold street, Wade said,
"I sure hope the some bitch don't get into a panic and run out of there. We'd never find him."
How dark everything was. Regal could barely see the cracked, weed-ridden pavement under his shoes as he and Wade started off.
"Isn't this to hell and gone?" Wade said. "They always stick these bus stations in the slums if it's a big enough town to have slums, and if it don't, then it's out to hell and gone like this."
He strode along, crunching the miscellaneous debris that neither of them could see.
"Sure dark," he said. "What do they got, a street light every 2 miles?
From behind them, a hoarse shout caused both of them to stop. Regal turned around and saw, standing in the blue neon light of the nonpareil coach line sign, the other soldier. He had staggered out of the waiting room after them. Now he leaned first one way and then the other, yelling after them, walking a few steps, stopping, setting down the 2 suitcases that he lugged.
"Aw, Jesus," Wade said. "We gotta go back. Otherwise he'll fall on his face and we'll never find him."
He started back and Regal had no choice but to go along.
"He'll sleep all night in the vacant lot here."
When they reached the soldier, he caught hold of Wade, rested against him and said,
"Guys walked off and left me." "You got to stay here," Wade said. "Stay here with the luggage while we go hunt up the car."
"I gotta drive,"
Phil said. At great length, Wade again explained the situation to him. Regal, wandering about helplessly, wondered if he could stand it. Finally, Wade picked up one of the suitcases and started off. To Regal, he said,
"Let's get going. Take the other suitcase or he'll leave it off and we'll never see it again."
"Somebody must have rolled me,"
Phil muttered. They stumbled on and on.
Regal lost track of time and space. One street light grew, passed overhead, flooding them temporarily with brilliant yellow light, and then died away behind them. The next one grew in its turn. They passed the vacant lot, and a square, inert factory building appeared instead. He and his two companions labored across multiple tracks, one after another. To his right, concrete loading docks at shoulder level hove close. Phil stumbled against one and came to rest against it, his head buried on his arm, evidently sound asleep. Ahead, at the curb, a car attracted Regal's attention.
"Is that it?" he said.
The two soldiers regarded the car.
"I think so," Wade said excitedly. "Hey, Phil, ain't that the car?"
"Sure,"
Phil said. The car sagged on one side. It had a flat. So they had found it.
"Now we gotta get a tire,"
Wade said, throwing the two suitcases into the back of the car.
"Let's get the jack under it and get the wheel off and see what size tire it takes."
In the trunk compartment, he and Regal found a jack. Phil had meanwhile wandered off. They saw him standing a few yards away, his head back, staring up at the sky.
"He'll stand like that for an hour," Wade said as they jacked up the car. "There's the Texaco station back a ways. We passed it just before the flat."
Showing skill and experience, he got the wheel off and rolled it onto the sidewalk. Regal followed.
"Where's Phil?"
Wade said, looking around. Phil was nowhere to be seen.
"Goddamn him," Wade said. "He must have rambled off."
Regal said, "Let's get to the gas station. I don't have all night, and neither do you."
"That's a fact," Wade said.
"Well," he said philosophically,
"maybe he'll come back and flop in the car, and we'll find him there when we get back."
He began rolling the tire and wheel at a good speed. The gas station, when they got to it, was dark. The proprietor had closed up and gone home.
"I'll be a bug-eared frag," Wade said.
"Maybe there's another station nearby," Regal said.
"I don't remember another one," Wade said. "How do you like that?"
He seemed stunned, unable to act any further.
"Come on," Regal said. "Let's go."
After a long, hard interval of tramping along, they saw ahead of them the white and red and blue square of a standard station.
"Amen," Wade said. "You know," he said happily to Regal, "I've been walking along here praying like a bastard, and there it is."
He rolled his tire and wheel faster and faster, squalling a cry of triumph.
"Come on!"
he yelled back to Regal. In the station, a clean-cut boy in the starched white uniform of the company watched them without interest.
"Hey there, man," Wade said, shoving open the station house door. "You want to sell us a tire? Let's move it."
The boy put down a chart he had been working on, picked up a cigarette from an ashtray, and came over to see the tire.
"What's this for?" he asked Wade.
36 Dodge sedan," Wade said.
The boy flashed a light on the tire, trying to read the size. Then he got out a heavy-ringed note binder and leafed through the printed pages. It seemed to Regal that he examined each page at least four different times, turning them first one way and then another. Finally, he closed the note binder and said,
"Can't do you any good."
"What do you suggest, then?" Regal said patiently. "The soldier and his buddy have to be back at their base or they're AWOL."
The gas station attendant scratched his nose with his pencil, and then he said,
"There's a recap place up on the highway, about 5 miles.
"We can't walk 5 miles, Regal said.
The attendant said, "I've got my Ford pickup truck parked over there." He pointed with his pencil. "One of you stay here and leave your wheel here, and the other of you can drive the pickup over to the highway. It's a seaside station. At the first light, bring the tire back and I'll put it on here for you. It'll cost you 6 bits for me to put it on." He took down a set of car keys from the register and handed them to Regal.
"And," he said, "while you're up there, there's an all-night restaurant across the highway. You want to bring me back a fried ham and cheese sandwich and a malt?"
"Any special kind of malt?" Regal said.
"Pineapple, I guess."
He handed Regal a dollar bill.
"I'll stay here," Wade said. Hurry back! He yelled after him.
Okay,
Regal said. A few minutes later, he had backed the pickup truck out onto the deserted street. Then he was driving in the direction the attendant had pointed. At last, he saw the lights of the highway. What a situation, he thought to himself.